Welcome to Better Off Red.
Hey, everybody. I'm Danny Katch.
I'm Jen Rush.
And I'm Eric Reuter.
This week, we have a really special episode. We have an interview with Kevin Cooper, who's a longtime inmate on California's death row for a crime he didn't commit. You'll hear all about it soon. It's such an important and profound and moving interview that we decided not to, do something different this week and not have our usual opener because it just felt too incongruous. So you're going to be hearing an interview with Kevin Cooper from San Quentin prison, where you're going to unfortunately hear the interruption every 5 to 10 minutes of the monitors of the prison phone call. But we think it'll be worth it. And yeah, we just wanted to give it a little... this conversation, a bit of an extended introduction. It's an issue that all three of us have been involved in, and Kevin refers to the work of groups like the Campaign and the Death Penalty a lot in it. So yeah, let me just stop talking, and you guys who conducted the interview, you know, can give a little intro.
Yeah, and I just want to say how grateful we are to Kevin for taking the time to talk to us. He gets 2 phone calls
per week,
and each night that he gets to make a phone call, he gets 1 phone call. So he chose to spend that with us. So we took as much time as we could with him, and we're deeply appreciative. And we hope that we can get his voice out to more people, because one of the things he says that his supporters can do in this is to get the word out and to get the truth out about how the prosecutors lied, about how the system is racist, how it's stacked against the poor, to really try to build support for his case. But one thing you'll hear over and over again in this interview is that Kevin Cooper is not just about fighting for himself, but is about fighting for all the people on death row and against all the injustices in our society. And it's really inspiring.
Yeah, his case has returned to some national prominence in the recent weeks and months because of some articles that New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has written. And I think that those have been really critical to giving this case, you know, this profile, and it's creating some pressure that state officials in California are finding it hard to continue to ignore so that he can get justice in his case some 35 years later. But as we know, justice delayed is justice denied. But it's not just these articles by Nicholas Kristof. As you hear Kevin talk about, he's been connected to a whole campaign around the death penalty for years. We all three remember in 2004 when he came within 4 hours of being executed, and he talks about that in the interview. And we all became activists around the death penalty, or were part of that movement through the campaign to end the death penalty, which Kevin talks about, but also because we're socialists. The campaign to end the death penalty itself was something that was launched by the International Socialist Organization in connection with and in collaboration with other activists who are against the criminal injustice system, and that formed in the wake of the stay of execution that that Mumia Abu-Jamal was granted sitting on Pennsylvania's death row. And that in turn kicked off a series of fights against the death penalty all across the country. I was in Chicago at the time and really involved in the struggle against the death penalty in Illinois. And there were struggles in California and New York and kind of all different places in between in the years that followed.
Yeah, our thinking with the campaign to end the death penalty was that it was the sharp edge of the criminal justice system, and that by exposing it, we could expose the racism that lies at the heart of the criminal injustice system and hope to crack open that fight, which can seem, you know, today we have Black Lives Matter. We've had movements against the criminal injustice system, movements for prison, more and more people calling themselves prison abolitionists. But in the late 90s, when the campaign was launched, there really wasn't a strong anti-racist movement in that kind of way around the death penalty. And, you know, the campaign listed 6 reasons to oppose the death penalty. Well, I was going to say that, but they've expanded it to 6, according to their website.
Okay. What's the 6th? What are the 5, and then give us the 6th?
It's actually a really good one. The death penalty is racist. The death penalty punishes the poor. The death penalty condemns the innocent to die. The death penalty is not a deterrent to violent crime. The death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. Those were the first five. And the sixth, which I imagine was added as a result of the experience of campaign activists working with people on death row and seeing the leadership role that they played in the struggle, is that the death penalty fails to recognize that guilty people have the potential to change, denying them the opportunity to ever rejoin society.
Mm. Yeah, that's really crucial. And it goes to one of the things that also animated the campaign to end the death penalty from the beginning that was somewhat distinctive at that time, which is that it really sought to place the voices of death row prisoners themselves at the heart of the movement. And, you know, as was stated in the five reasons, or five plus one, six reasons, is that, you know, it there's innocent people end up on death row. But that wasn't the only reason that the campaign sought to abolish the death penalty. Of course, it's all those other things as well. And we organized and took up the cause of all sorts of people and stopping the executions of all sorts of people, regardless of whether they are innocent or guilty or who knows what. But I do think that one of the things that gave us the idea for doing this podcast interview was that one of the big innovations that the campaign to end the death penalty did, and I think this was an idea that Mike Stark in Washington, D.C. had, was to set up what we called live from death row events, where we would have people, like we just did with Kevin, call into a meeting or some sort of public event and then hook that phone up to amplification and essentially bring the voices of death row prisoners right to audiences of 50 or 100 or hundreds of people. And it was really important for getting the word out and for humanizing people on death row, because of course that is so much about what the system tries to do in order to carry out these executions, is to dehumanize the people that they have incarcerated and that they seek to execute.
Yeah. And like the campaign itself, I think the whole idea of Live from Death Row took inspiration from Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose book Live from Death Row was getting his voice out to tens of thousands, if not millions of people. Similarly, the movement in Philadelphia against Mumia's execution really fueled the movement against the death penalty. I remember one of the earliest, the first Live from Death Row that I got to hear was Tyrone X. Gilliam, who was murdered by the state of Maryland. But one of the things he said that just, I think, really encapsulates this question, he said, my crime, and he admitted to being guilty as part of a crime that took place. He said, my crime was the result of poverty and desperation. Politicians kill for power and prestige. And I think that that's something that you'll hear Kevin Cooper talking about in this interview.
Another thing that I remember Tyrone X. Gilliam talking about in Live from Death Row is he said that being on death row was like having a gun to your head constantly, and some days you want them to pull the trigger and some days you don't, just wow. In terms of what that experience was like. One other thing I want to just mention in this intro as well is that we talked to Kevin Cooper about the incredibly dramatic events in 2004 when he was hours away from execution, and you're going to hear from that, but some of the stuff that maybe doesn't come through the interview as much is the depth of the campaign that mobilized around him, hundreds of people, you know, which Jen talks about in the interview, but activists from Angela Davis to Jesse Jackson mobilizing around this.
In addition to Jesse Jackson and Angela Davis, there was some of the Hollywood types, Danny Glover, Janine Garofalo, Angelica Houston. There was Reuben Hurricane Carter, and then our friend Howard Zinn, who I believe was at the founding event for the campaign to end the death penalty. And Noam Chomsky was also one of the people that signed on for justice in Kevin Cooper's case. So all of these different forces, the grassroots struggle, the live from death row events, the high profile people who signed on to his case, and the big protests in particular on the day of on the days leading up to the execution, kind of came together to get Kevin Cooper back out of the execution chamber, which he talks about in the interview with really some incredible power.
I mean, yeah, I think mostly we're just incredibly grateful that that movement did save Kevin Cooper's life so that he could continue to fight and continue to be such a leading voice and get to this moment where hopefully we can build a movement, and hopefully there is enough pressure on these politicians that they have to actually take up his innocence claim and actually win freedom for him, because I don't think there's any justice, but hopefully there can be freedom for him. So if you want background on the case, we will link to the article by Nicholas Kristof in the show notes. You can also go to episode 12, in which we have an introduction in which we talk more about some of the details and the specifics of the case. But really, this interview is not just about Kevin's case, but it's really him talking about racism, class, oppression, and his education as a Black man behind bars. And I think that that's really what's incredibly powerful for it. And so we're gonna turn to it right now. If you want to support his campaign, go to savekevincooper.org and sign the petition for his clemency. And please spread the word about this case, because this is a moment that really matters for him.
No more lying friends, wanting tragic ends. Though they do pretend, they won't go when I go.
Just a quick note before we get to Kevin. If you listen to this show and you like what we do and you want to help support us and make it easier for us to do more of this work, go to patreon.com and make a monthly contribution. It's patreon.com/betteroffredpod. Thanks.
Right here from the start, and they won't go when I go.
Global CalLink, you have a collect call from an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin, California. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded. Please hold. To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global CalLink.
Hello?
Well, it's an honor to speak with you, and really thank you for taking the time to speak with Better Off Red today. Your case is going to be known to some of the people in our audience, but then not to others. So I just wondered if you'd be willing to introduce yourself to our audience and maybe tell people a little bit about your personal history.
My name is Kevin Cooper, and I'm currently incarcerated at San Quentin Prison. I've been here since 1985 after being wrongfully convicted of murdering 4 people, attempting to murder a 5th person, and escaping from a prison in California called Chino.
All of us here who are sitting around this table who work on this podcast, we all remember the day in 2004 when we heard that you'd received a stay of execution, and that was a pretty big day for us. We were all, somewhat younger activists than we are today, but really involved in the struggle against the death penalty. And it seems really exciting that today you were on the verge of finally getting the advanced DNA testing of evidence in your case that could exonerate you. There's been a number of things that have led to this, including some great articles by the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof. And it's now looks like there's, state officials who are even paying attention to this. And this seems really hopeful and different than what's gone before. But I wanted to ask you, what your take is on all that. Is that also your opinion? Where do you think things are today in your case?
First, disrespect, but that was not my execution. That was my murder, my torture and murder at the hands of these people. On February the 10th, 2004, on February the 9th, 2004, I came within 3 hours and 42 minutes of being strapped down to that gurney, injected with lethal poison, tortured, murdered by these homicidal maniacs called volunteer executioners here at this prison. So I do not claim anything in this place as being mine. I'm here against my will.
Mm-hmm.
I have been fortunate in the fact that I survived that madness, and while I suffered a little post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards, with the help of people who cared about me, he managed to get me over that hump.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I've been fighting very hard along with many other people, not only to prove my innocence, but to prove that
this call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Not only to prove my innocence, but to prove that the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department framed me
mm-hmm.
for those murders which I was wrongly convicted of. Yes, it's true that the governor's office is finally acting a little bit after having my clemency petition on their desk for over 2.5 years, in which they did nothing. They are not doing anything now because they want to. They're doing what they're doing now, and all they're doing is sending a questionnaire to my attorneys, asking them exactly what kind of testing we want and what laboratory would do it and other questions of that nature. And they're doing it because of public pressure, because of, yes, the Nicholas Kristof piece, but also because other people have come forward and exposed other parts of this case as concerning new witnesses, have come forward and say that they saw who was driving the victim's stolen car the morning after the murders, and it was not me. Other evidence has come forward, which I can't talk about right now, but the governor's office knows about. And then you had this Senators Kamala D. Harris and Dianne Feinstein coming out and saying that I should be granted testing. So it's not that the governor is doing or his legal affairs secretary, Peter Krause, is doing anything because they want to do it. We're making them do what little that they're doing. Hopefully, they will give me what I really want. And it's not just advanced DNA testing, but it's also an innocence investigation, because that is part of my clemency request. That they give us an innocence investigation and a hearing so we can expose all the corruption, all the tampering with evidence, all the destroying evidence, all the lying about evidence, all the tampering with witnesses, and everything else that we now know that they did in order to convict me.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it seems like at this point, they would want this to go away quietly if you get the advanced DNA testing, but you have been working to shed light on the injustice system that, you know, landed you in this situation in the first place. Like you said, all the corruption that's involved. I'm wondering, this is Jen, I'm wondering, you talked about the people who helped you get through the PTSD and get through the experience in 2004. And you also talked about the public pressure that exists on the governor and on Kamala Harris and all these people who've come out. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that movement, about what some of the struggles have looked like, how you've kept the inspiration to keep fighting, being on death row for all these decades. I think you've given inspiration to us on the outside, but how have you managed to keep that fight going on the inside?
Very simple. The question about my activism and my fighting is because early on when I came to this prison, I was very uneducated and miseducated of the ways of the United States government. I was fortunate enough to meet some activists mm-hmm. who eventually, through their work, introduced me to people from an organization which no longer exists. And that was called the Campaign in the Death Penalty. And through those people, I met many activists, many people who taught me about this movement I knew nothing about activism, about human rights, about humanity, about many other things that helped me to become the person that I am now. This is why I am doing this podcast with you, because of my appreciation for the work that Cameron and Elizabeth and Crystal and many other people from the Campaign in the Death Penalty gave to me. In fact, I could often say this truth to you, that I would not be alive today if it wasn't for the campaign and the death penalty. Because it was the work that they did and activism that they took, which woke many people up to a case that many people didn't want to hear about, which was mine. They also got my case to the Northern California Innocence Project, who in turn found the law firm that's representing me now, or Carrington Sutcliffe, which ultimately got me that stay of execution in 2004, when I came within 3 hours and 42 minutes of being murdered by these people. So I've had a grassroots teaching. I learned, I was a blank piece of paper, and I learned from the campaign and the death penalty. And I am very thankful for all the help that they gave me. This is why I'm able to continue on the work that I do, even though the majority of those people are no longer in my life. But the lessons that they taught me will remain in my life as long as I'm alive. I have been able to work with different people who won't even work with each other in this fight to end this horrific and historic crime against humanity, the death penalty. And I've been, I guess you can say, very lucky to be able to do that, because it's going to take all of us to end this thing. And it will get ended.
I wanted to ask you about a particular person who played a role in your case. That is California Attorney General Bill Lockyer, because he seems to have been a central figure who was more committed to his image of being tough on crime than really in getting at the truth. And he's a Democrat, but so are many California state officials. So I wondered if you could speak some about the role of Lockyer in your case and other Democrats and how that has shaped and, you know, impacted overall this, your struggle for justice.
Right. I am not a, how you can say, a political person, because I understand that politics, two things I stay away from is religion and politics, because they both have had a detrimental effect on poor people, especially black people, in the history of this country. Malcolm X called the Republicans the wolves and the Democrats the foxes. Mm-hmm. But each, it's just as deadly when it comes to killing their prey. I am prey to those people. Bill Locklear, as you see it, was more interested in being tough on crime. And while Kamala Harris, when she was the Attorney General, while she wasn't as tough on crime as he was, she still did the same thing that he did. Right? She ignored my case. He ignored my case. Even though he was the Attorney General that tried to get me.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Even though he was the Attorney General that tried to get me tortured, murdered by these people, he ignored my case up until then. I look at Senator Dianne Feinstein, who in 1996, I believe it was the only Democrat in Washington, D.C., to co-sponsor that anti-terrorism effective death penalty.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
That anti-death penalty effective, anti-terrorism effective death penalty act is used to keep my case from being heard in federal court on an actual innocence claim.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton was the Democratic president to sign that into law. And it's the same Democrats who claim to be just who are the people who are denying me justice. Let me hang up and call back.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
All right.
Okay, sounds good.
Hang up and call back.
All right.
This is Global CalLink. You have a collect call from
Kevin.
An inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin, California. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded. Please hold. To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global CalLink.
Hello?
Hi, Kevin. We're back.
Hi, Kevin.
What I was saying, and I want to finish that off, I speak the truth when I say that these Democrats, you know, who claim to be about justice, are the ones, the very ones, that are denying me justice. This is what Governor Brown is doing right now. He had no intention on hearing my clemency You know, he had none. He didn't even read my clemency petition. It's set wherever it's at, Sacramento, over 2.5 years, even though everything in it, and even more is what Kristoff exposed in mm-hmm. his piece that he wrote, and others have exposed in their piece. So my point is, in my opinion, that's all I can give is my opinion, man. There ain't no difference between these Republicans and Democrats. They're all the same. They just have, wear different clothes. One wears red, one wears blue, but they all the same. Kamala Harris told Mr. Kristoff that she's sorry that she didn't do nothing on my case when she was the Attorney General, but she was relying on her...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
She was relying on the people up under her to tell her the truth. But it didn't happen. So I can see it now. Here I, you know, on my tombstone, here lies Kevin Cooper, tortured, murdered by the state of California for murders he didn't commit. But Senator Kamala Harris is sorry.
Yeah.
Her sorriness don't do no damn good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she wasn't sorry till Nicholas Kristof talked about her in the New York Times, and she wants to run for president.
Right, right. You know, so that's my opinion. You know, I used to, when I grew up, I was miseducated. That's what I mean. My parents were Democrats. Mm. They believed in what them people stood for. You know, but I can't see it. So
why?
Next question.
Well, this is kind of a follow-up to that question. Why do you think it is, given your incredibly strong claims of innocence, that they don't want to reopen this case? What do they have to fear? What do they have to lose, in your opinion, by opening up this case and granting your clemency and investigating your innocence claim, which is what you're asking for?
I have to add to that question like this. The late James Baldwin said, whenever a victim articulates what it is to be a victim, he or she ceases to be a victim and they become a threat.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me. A damn, I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn about a brother like me and myself, because they never did. I wasn't with it, but just that very minute it occurred to me, the suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in my cell. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get out, but that thought was thought before. I contemplated a plan on the cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me begun to be another one. Public enemy serving time, they drew the line, y'all. They criticized me for some crime. Nevertheless,
the
they could not
work
understand
that I keep
that
I'm here.
A black man.
They know what I do. They read my essays out like they hear me when I speak out. And live from death row events across the country or whatever, if they're listening to what I'm saying to you right now. They understand that with my voice, and if we prove everything that we're going to prove, the death penalty in this state is going to come to an end. And there's millions and millions of dollars invested in keeping this death penalty alive. So I believe that these people are scared of the truth. They say they want the truth. We don't want the truth. That's on one hand. But on the other hand, I'm a black man in America that was convicted, rightly or wrongly. I was convicted of murdering white people. Somebody got to pay for that.
Hmm.
It looked like they had an easy walk walking me into that death chamber in 2004. And they think they had an easy walk walking me up there this time. They want me dead. They want me dead so somebody can pay for what happened to those people. Which I explained to a producer at KNBC LA 2 weeks ago when I did an interview with her, that whatever was going to happen to those people was going to happen to them. Regardless, if I had stayed in that prison or I walked away, I had nothing to do with it. Nothing. They still want me to pay. I mean, the California Department of Corrections uses my case when they train their incoming recruits to be prison guards at their academy They use photos of the crime scene. They use photos of me.
Whoa.
To say why we need the death penalty and why I'm on death row and all this other stuff. And I know this because a correctional officer come up and told me about it.
Mm. Wow.
You know, so they have a vested interest in killing me. The California Department of Corrections was the biggest donator to Prop 66. That law that passed to speed up the death penalty in California. They put in the most money.
That's what I wanted to actually ask you about next. You just mentioned Prop 66, which was a ballot measure that passed very narrowly in the November 2016 election. And it changed the procedures for executions and essentially undid a permanent injunction, which had been issued in 2012, that had brought all executions to a halt in California. And I think even before that, the last one that was carried out was in 2006. And I think a lot of people didn't hear much about those ballot measures because that was the same election in which Donald Trump got elected. And that kind of became the big story of that election. But and like you were just saying, like it came with millions of dollars poured into that battle. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what that 2016 ballot measure struggle looked like and what you think the implications are for the death penalty in California more broadly and also for your case in particular.
Personally speaking, I could get back in the state court under Prop 1473, which was a legislative ruling that was passed by the legislatures in California, signed into law by Governor Brown, which means that any inmate who comes up with new evidence of innocence, even DNA testing, can take their case back to court and get in court. Now, I'm not too much worried about myself getting executed because, like I said, I can get back into court. And we have disproved these people's case against me. Now, does it mean I will not be executed? No. These people have no problem murdering innocent people. In this country was this country, as it is now, was built on land stolen from innocent people who had genocide committed upon them. This country was built on the backs of innocent people who were turned into slaves.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
For those Native Americans, those indigenous people, and the Africans that built this country were all innocent. They had some of the greatest crimes against humanity perpetrated upon their body. My point is, I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I do know there. But I have a voice, and I'm going to use my voice until I cannot use it anymore. But there are many men and women on death row in this state because California has the largest women's death row in the world. And there are many men and women on death row who do not have a voice. And so I must speak for them because they can't speak for themselves, whether they're mentally ill or whatever the case may be. They're just not in a position to do so. I am. I'm trying to make it so they don't get strapped down to a gurney and tortured murder. Prop 66, on its face, looks like it would speed up executions, but in reality, it won't. The California Supreme Court had to change the writing of it itself in order to uphold it, saying that the mandatory language about all cases being heard in 5 years was a suggestion and not mandatory. Right? So there are other cases in Superior Court challenging Prop 66 and the lethal injection protocols because, from my understanding, the only part of Prop 66 that were on the protocols was a choice of lethal gas or lethal injection. All the other things that are used in these protocols were not part of Prop 66. So therefore, they are being challenged in lower court, meaning that if they get turned down, they can't restart executions. And this is going to keep dragging on and keep dragging on and keep dragging on. So there's a chance that still this thing may not get restarted. This prison, San Quentin, this modern day plantation, has two death chambers. It has the old death chamber, which is lethal gas, and they have the Arnold Schwarzenegger torture and death chamber, which was built in secret. Taxpayers' money when he was the governor, which they now want to use for lethal injection. But hopefully both of them will end up in the museum and never be used again. There are people in this state fighting attorneys, law firms, and they are making progress. So it's still up in the air whether or not this thing will be restarted. But there's a chance it may, and there's a chance it may not. We just have to keep fighting. I'm going to keep fighting until I can't fight no more, because that's what I do.
You spoke about how they have a vested interest in murdering you. And in the New York Times article, you're quoted as saying you're frameable because you're a black man in America. In the last couple of years, one of the inspiring developments has been the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm wondering what your view of that is from behind bars, what the impact, what you see as the impact of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Put this in its proper context. Personally, I love Black Lives Matter because Black Lives do matter.
Right.
You know, they speak for me. They are fighting for me. Just like with the poor people's march that just happened in Washington, D.C., and around the country, they speak for me too. And they speak for all of us on death row because only poor people are on death row. It's poor people who get strapped down to these nonies and murdered. And while the states like to say that the majority of people that we execute are white people, and that may be true, and they say that just to say that this system is not racist, but when they say that, racism may jump out the window, but classism jumps in.
Mm-hmm.
So between racism and classism, the only people you're killing are poor whites, poor blacks, poor Latinos, poor Asians, poor Native Americans, and so forth and so on down the line. So Black Lives Matter speaks for me, and they speak for many others. But they also are part of a long history of black people who gathered and formed organizations and spoke out. You can go with that to Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, and work your way forward. So Marcus Garvey and his movement, you know, and all the way up to Black Panthers. Every generation, you have SNCC, right? You have CORE. You had the Urban League. You had all these different organizations coming to the fore, going their time.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
On their time on this earth to form organizations to do what Black Lives Matter is doing now. It's just been a different name and a different people, but they're still fighting the same fight. They're still struggling for the same thing. They're still dying for the same cause. So that's part of our history. Struggle is our middle name. And so I love those people, those youngsters. I can't wait to...
You have 30 seconds remaining.
So I'm going to hang up and call back.
Okay.
To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global Tel Link.
As I was saying, throughout the history of this country, even this world, I'm not even going to limit my people to this country. I will be insulting them. We have always had people who have formed organizations or groups or even as individuals who have spoken out about our plight at the hands of the oppressors. And it's true for all people. All people have different people speak up for them. So Black Lives Matter has came out of a place of necessity, but also out of someone understanding the fact that this is part of our history, that every generation has had someone to speak up for them as a people. I mean, I remember reading Frederick Douglass way back then, he said, what to a slave is your 4th of July. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he spoke out powerfully about this stuff, and he did it not for himself, but for all his people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I understand that they are needed, even though they are part of this country who doesn't appreciate them, doesn't want them, and respond to them. But we need them. We need their voice. We need their activism. We need their concern and their love and their respect, and everybody should give it to them. I just want them to include capital punishment in what they're doing, because it's happening out there in the streets. They will form behind the death penalty. Behind what happened to Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Right.
That was the death penalty. That was the front end of this criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm at the back.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I'm in the back end of this criminal justice system. were cops. Don't shoot me with guns, but they strap me down to a table or a chair and do what they want to do until I'm dead, till I am no more. And that's the same thing that's happening on the front end of the criminal justice system where they are. So it's all connected. And we have to get people to make that connection. And that's what I'm trying to do. You know, when I back in the day when Occupy was around, I wrote this essay called Occupy Death Row. Because I didn't want the Occupy movement to forget about us the way so many other movements have come. Mm-hmm. And they forgot about us. People want death row. And so they had an Occupy San Quentin event. And at that time, this prison was so paranoid that Occupy was going to rush the front gate and do all this stuff. They saw my name as one of the endorsers of it, that they took me down to a cage and strip searched me, looking for tattoos, wondering what I was doing with the Occupy movement. You know, and they came up here and they tore up this cage that I live in, and they took all my Black History papers, all my Black Panther papers, all my stuff on Attica, almost anything about anything that had to do with Black people. Wow. And us surviving in this country, they took it all. I was doing a protest painting for one of my attorneys. They took the painting out, took it down to the office and photographed it, looking for hidden messages in it. And that Occupy San Quentin event was the most peaceful event that these people ever had up here. Occupy members came up here and they spoke their piece. Ex-prisoners came up here and spoke their piece. Everybody, I wrote an essay and it was read out. The other death row inmates wrote essays and it was read. KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California, they covered the event. And it was a good event. But yet I paid a hell of a price for doing it. And I would do it again if I had to. Because like Black Lives Matters, I'm trying to make a difference.
Ever feel kind of down and out? You don't know just what to do. Living all of your days in darkness, let the sun shine through. Ever feel that somehow, somewhere you lost your way? And if you don't get a help quick, you won't make it through the day. Or could you call on
difference already. It's interesting you raise Occupy because Occupy happened at the exact same time that Troy Davis, another innocent Black man on death row, was murdered. And one of the things early on was that people were marching for Troy Davis and went to Occupy and talked about what was happening there and made those connections. So I think we have to keep raising the issue of the death penalty. A lot of people, because the executions have slowed down, it seems like a lot of people think that it's not in the newspapers in the same kind of way, but it just seems like the death penalty is the legalized expression of, like you're saying, the murder of Michael Brown. And we have to, you know, if we can fight the death penalty, that would be a huge blow for their side.
No, I agree with everything that you just stated. And my point is, every time you see these police murder in cold blood, an innocent person out there,
mm-hmm.
not only are they killing that person, but for example, Michael Brown, Trayvon, right? Jordan Davis, mm-hmm. many other people who were murdered by these people. Every single time I hear the voice of a Black mother cry out, what did they do to my son? What did they do to my daughter? I hear the voice of Miss Mamie Till. Mamie Till's mother. This historical crowd of Black women goes back generations in this country. And they all cry the same thing.
Yeah, I wanted to get back to how you had raised the way in which you had become educated behind bars, and you just went through some of the papers and books and writing and so on that you had that was taken from you around Occupy San Quentin, or was it Occupy Death Row? And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how you first got introduced to some of these ideas and to activism.
What I did was everyday people. Just everyday people who care, who belong to Campaign and the Death Penalty and other different similar organizations, but mostly just people who care.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And they cared enough about me, after meeting me, to educate me. And my life was changed forever because of that, because they did not browbeat me with anything. They did not try to indoctrinate me into anything. They let me read the books to find my own truth, to find my own way, my own path. And the majority of people that I met after opening books, I didn't even know their names. I didn't even know they existed. But I know their stories because their story is my story. Their history is my history. Here's my ancestors speaking to me from the grave. You know, telling me what happened to them, how they fought. And they fought with less, way less than what I have to fight with now. But they had the desire, they had the will, not just to live, not just to survive, but to fight the oppressor who was doing everything to them. And somehow or another, it leaped off those pages and this didn't get into my mind, it got into my heart. It got into my spirit. And, you know, this is not for everybody. I mean, I didn't choose this. This stuff chose me. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, there's over 700 men on death row, and there are many of us are speaking out against this horrific and historic crime against humanity. But the vast majority of these people in here are complicit to their own oppression and death at the hands of these people. You know? But somehow, some way, I managed to read these books. And I could relate to what was going on. I mean, it was like they were talking to me personally. You know, when I read Frederick Douglass, who I love, you know, but when he said that no man can put a chain about the ankle of his fellow man without at last finding that the under end of that chain is fastened around his own neck, that let me know that those people, see, I used to remember like this. I used to wonder why certain slave masters would want to free their slaves before they died so they could die with a clean conscience. Well, like they did the right thing, because they knew that all the time that chain that was around their slaves' ankles was also fastened around their neck. Mm-hmm. And the only way they can free that chain off their neck was to free that chain off the ankle of that slave. Mm. So they freed them. So these type things, which I started reading, it made me want to fight. And I can already tell you today, like I said, if it weren't for the campaign and the death penalty and all the fighting that we did, I would be a dead man today. So yeah. Most of them were kids. When I met Crystal, she was like 19 years old. And she told me, Kevin, as long as you fight for yourself, I'll fight you. She said, don't give up, because miracles happen. And we're going to make this happen. And this was like a week or so before these people were going to murder me. But guess what? A miracle did happen.
That's what I was going to say. It did feel like a miracle happened back in 2004. I'm in New York, so I wasn't outside San Quentin, but I remember, you know, listening to the people, a 2-mile march of hundreds of people on San Quentin and hundreds of people outside San Quentin. And you talked earlier about the PTSD that you suffered after that, but what was going through your head in that moment? And what do you, if you could talk about that miracle, which wasn't a miracle because it didn't come from up above, but it came from all of us. And it came from you. But if you could talk about that moment a little.
Before there was a miracle, there was a nightmare. I mean, these people had me, you know, I can't go through the whole ritual death. It takes too much time. because it started in December 17, 2003, when I first got an execution date, you know, and it lasted all the way up till February 9, 2004. But that night, they had me standing butt naked in that death chamber waiting room on that cold-ass floor. And they were examining my body like I was a slave on the auction block. I used to read about that. My mind went to that. And it was an out-of-body experience as they examined me from head to toe and all points in between. I mean, they even searched my dick and my balls.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
They made me bend over and spread my cheeks so they could illuminate my bowels, shining the flashlight up my butt so they can see my death. It was so disgusting what they did to me, but it was the reality of what they do. They were trying to show me that my body wasn't mine, it was theirs, and they could do to me what they wanted to do, and there was nothing I could do about it, or they would kill me. I mean, they would beat me down back there if I had to.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Let me hang up and call back.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded. To accept this call, say or dial 5 now. Thank you for using Global Tel Link.
What I went through that night was unreal because it was real.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like something that you read in a book. Your life is being taken from you and there's nothing you can do about it. But the main thing that really got to me back here that while all this was going on is I happened to look up. I was surrounded by about 8 to 10 executioners. And they were all white. But then I happened to look up and I looked behind them and there were these two black men. Right? They were prison guards. They were big, like offensive linemen. They had no rank, but they were like the muscle. So something had went down, they was going to beat me down, I guess. And in my mind, I'm screaming at these people, these two black guards. I'm asking them in my mind, what the fuck are you doing helping these white men murder me? Don't you know this is part of our history? This is part of our slavery? This is, and all this stuff is going through my mind. I'm saying all this stuff to them in my mind, but not a word came out my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I was so traumatized. And I knew if I had said anything, those people would have beat me up before they strapped me down to torture me and murder me. You know what I mean? But just the fact that I'm watching these black people, these black men, these black prison guards participating in my torture and murder. It was something that was so shocking. It was unbelievably shocking. And then I had never seen them before that incident, and I have never seen them since that incident happened. I went through hell and back that night. And another reason why these people want to murder me, because they look at it as unfinished business. On February 9, 2004, when I walked into that death chamber waiting room, these people were going to murder me. I turned around and walked back out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first death inmate to ever do that. Every other inmate who went in there, they came out in a body bag. In the history of San Quentin Prison executing people, I was the first one to ever walk in and walk back up. So these, you know, a lot of these people, they don't forget. We didn't get in that time. We gonna get in this time. We gonna get it. And believe me, they got plans on it. So all I gotta do is keep fighting. I am.
I didn't know that you're the only person who had faced execution who had come into the death chamber and walked back out
in San Quentin.
Wow.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Just since me, there has been others. There's been another guy named Mike Morales,
uh-huh,
who went further along in the process than I did, but he eventually got a stay in.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
He ended up getting a stay and walking out too, but I was the first. You know, so there have been many firsts in this case,
mm-hmm,
sort of what I'm trying to do and what other people are trying to do as far as getting me out of here. We just keep building on firsts.
So you talked about this as a series of firsts. I mean, one question is, what can your supporters do now? Because obviously you're saying Jerry Brown's not just going to do this out of the goodness of his heart. And they, you know, we're in this moment where they're not yet ramping up the execution machine, but you could get a new execution date. What kinds of actions can people take now to support you and to spread the news about your case?
Exposing the truth about my case. That's the main thing. And I'm going to give you a prime example. The state likes to say that the DNA testing that happened in 2001 proves my guilt overwhelmingly.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what they're not telling anyone about. And this is in the clemency petition. It's in Doug Fletcher's dissent. And it's, you know, the United Nations knows about it because they spoke out about it. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights knows about it because they addressed this issue as well. People were supposed to have been found in the victim's house. This is one of the things that they claimed that was DNA tested. A drop of blood, a very small drop of blood, in the hallway on the lower wall. And the state said it came from me, and it matched me. Okay. Now, during the testing on this little bit of blood in 1983 and 1984, that little bit of blood was completely consumed. It was completely exhausted. I mean, it was no more. It was completely used up in testing. In 2001, the state claimed that that drop of blood was DNA tested, and it matched me. So if something was completely used up and consumed or exhausted in 1983, how could it be DNA tested in 2001? It can't be. Those tests in 2001 were bogus. We can prove they were bogus. And the same thing goes to a hand-rolled cigarette butt. It was a hand-rolled cigarette paper. It was 4 millimeters when they took it apart and tested it in 1983. Okay, and they completely used that paper up in the testing. They put it in liquid. It dissolved. Paper dissolves in liquid. But in 2001, the state said they DNA tested it. But the thing about it wasn't 4 millimeters no more. Even though it was completely used up and consumed, it was 7.7 millimeters in length, which means it grew. How come when you take something apart and test it and use it up, how can it grow? It can't grow. And plus, it was re-rolled. So that was another bogus DNA test, and we can prove that. And then the T-shirt had EDTA on it, which means it came from a test tube, the blood that was on that. So our point is, we can prove all this stuff, but the governor won't even look at it. So the best thing that anybody that's trying to help me, and by helping me, you're helping in the death penalty, is expose the truth. Those tests could not have happened in 2001 as the state claims they did because the evidence was used up in 83. And if you think I'm lying, all you have to do is get Judge Fletcher's dissent. It's online. It might be on my website. Hey, read it. I mean, this is what we're in the process of doing now, exposing all these truths. Kristoff knows about this, even though he didn't expose it in his last piece. But when he writes another one, he's going to expose it. We're going to put so much pressure on these people that they're going to kill me or they're going to let me go. And no middle ground. No middle ground in this case.
I was just saying what you just described in terms of the absolute fabrication of evidence and so on. I think today is something that more people are inclined to believe than before, as a result of things like Black Lives Matter, of all of these videos of police abusing and harassing and killing people, I think that we've come to a moment where the fact that police lie as a regular matter of course of what they do in the criminal justice process is now something that's more broadly accepted perhaps than it's been in at least in a very long time. And I would think that that's going to...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And I would think that's going to actually be in your favor when it comes to bringing these things, not just to the courts, of course, but also to the court of public opinion, which, as we know, they're very sensitive to in these sorts of cases.
And not just that, but a few months ago, maybe 3 months, they had a man named Benavides that had to release from death row here in the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
He was on death row for 24 years, but he was convicted with false evidence. The California Supreme Court overturned his conviction based on his conviction on false evidence. So it's not like this stuff don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can prove it happens, but people have to read and know about it, and this is what the government and them don't want to do, but we have to make them do it. And we're trying to do that. You know, and that's all we can do is try. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to me personally. I don't know whether, you know, they're going to murder me or whatever, but I do know that my days as a free man have never been. And I was fooling myself when I was out there and thought I was free. If I got out tomorrow, I would not be free. I would just no longer be on a plantation. I would no longer have to worry about being strapped down to a gurney and tortured, murdered by executioners on the back end. I'd have to worry about a police shooting and killing me on the front end of this criminal justice system for any reason or no reason at all. You know, that doesn't happen to a free person. That happens to a person that is not wanted, expendable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these types of crimes against humanity has happened to poor people in this country and black people, particularly in this country. And that happened to a free people.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to an oppressed people. I am an oppressed person. I understand this now when I didn't know it before.
So,
but as an oppressed person, I'm fighting. Yes, go ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to say this is your opportunity to speak in your words and your voice to thousands of people. And so we were just going to ask you what you want to say to people, if there's anything sort of to close out that you think is important that you want to say, your message, your words, your voice. That's kind of where we wanted to end things, not our questions, but what you have to say.
First, I would like to thank all people who are fighting for whatever they're fighting for. They're standing up and speaking out and fighting. Thank you. Thank you for not being complicit to your own oppression. We people who are being oppressed have more in common than that, no matter of our skin color or our religious beliefs or our sexual orientation or whatever. If we're being oppressed by one person because of that, then that same person who's oppressing you is oppressing me. And whoever is oppressing me is oppressing somebody else, because that's what oppressors do. They oppress. They don't give a damn who they oppress. So it's up to us to unite and to work together and to continue to do what generations of people have done before us. It's to fight, you know, to mobilize, to organize, to speak out, to stand up, you know. And those of you who will help me personally, I thank you, but I'm more concerned with the death penalty as a whole, because this thing is bigger than any one person. It's bigger than me, and it's bigger than Mamiya, and bigger than anybody else. You know, this is about a system. It's historically and systematically has murdered men, women, and children look just like me, just because they can. And when I say look like me, I don't mean necessarily because of my skin color. I'm talking about because of my class. You know? So keep on keeping on and doing what you're doing. And I thank everybody for their involvement, because if you're not in this fight, you can't complain about nothing. It's only the people who are fighting who can complain. Those people who are complicit, and that's your bad. As Oscar Wilde said, man, every saint has a...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
And every sinner has a future. Well, let's do this. A struggle of solidarity from Death Row. I'm Kevin Cooper. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I hope the next time we talk, you are out from behind bars and out from the plantation. You are an inspiration. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Peace to you. Take care.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom?
Thank you for listening. We hope you were as moved as we were. And we would appreciate it if you share this with everyone you know and get it out as widely as possible. We really hope that getting this story out can make a difference. Thanks for listening.
One more thing. We want to give a special thanks to Cameron Sturdivant for setting up this interview with Kevin Cooper.
Free Kevin Cooper.
Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill.